Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Tomás Clancy and Serena Bellissimo are with us once again. Good afternoon to you all.
Good afternoon.
Did you start the movies and booze part very early?
I don't know. It was just two cracking items we did there,
cool.
One after the other. There's nothing like manspreading and the flat earth to get people going.
Two great films for Christmas.
Two great films for Christmas. Tomás was telling us just before we became on air that you were down doing a Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, we were doing a Thanksgiving dinner in Cork, Californian sort of ambiance, Californian wines, and lots of people having sort of turkey, it's having the traditional sort of Thanksgiving feast. We've concentrated so much on this being Black Friday and this whole thing.
I
loathe this idea, but we're in Black Friday. But Black Friday exists because yesterday, the third or the fourth Thursday in November. So they have a fixed date, which is the fourth Thursday in November, fixed by George Washington and Lincoln, in fact, and in several acts have fixed this there. So it's the only holiday they have that gets fixed like this. And that means that people are off celebrating for the full day, Thanksgiving, and they travel from all over to get back to their home for this. It's a big thing like Christmas. And that means that, obviously, the day is off. It's a dead day on Friday. Sales are down and so forth. So this was, thankfully, a Thanksgiving sort of feast, and looking, and we were talking them through the wines, and I was telling you a little about Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is really weird. The minute you think about it, you realise there's something terribly wrong here.
Mm.
Because your Thanksgiving, what are you thinking about? You're thinking about the pilgrims, pilgrim fathers with their big sort of Guy Fawkes hats and the buckles on their shoes and the black coats, and they're having the sort of Native American sort of there with them celebrating and playing games.
They're not.
They were having a lovely, lovely, lovely time enjoying the games with them. And this is in 1620. Now, in 1620, they discovered the Americas in 1498. So 1620, the minute you go, well, Thanksgiving, 1620, they weren't the first colony by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm.
They weren't even the first in New England. There was one in 1602 in Virginia. So this one in 1620, they just had great PR. So they pushed and pushed this. And in fact, they called themselves saints. And they were Calvinists from Humberside and Nottinghamshire. So they were Yorkshire and Nottinghamshire folk. They were very strict Calvinists. So they were, they felt the Church of England, the Puritans, were basically wayward libertines that they couldn't stand being around. They needed to get a little more austerity than that. And so the great thing was they had absolutely no skills as being pioneers. They were, butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, and so forth. They all got into a ship in 1620, sailed over to where half of them died over the Christmas time of the first time they landed there, because they forgot to build houses to get into. It was too harsh. And they said, they didn't have all the resources they need. They had not planned it well.
Mm.
But eventually it succeeded, and the following year they had their party, and it was a successful colony was established, and then it gets established as a holiday. So I was down there celebrating that.
I don't want to defame people from the north of England, but
yes,
it doesn't strike me as a north of England thing that people sit around and be all warm and gushy and huggy and talk about what they're thankful for.
Well, they weren't. I mean, but they were hardworking, uber Calvinist folk, and in fact they'd already left England. The whole story is incredible. Plymouth Rock is where they're supposed to land at Plymouth, but in fact they leave York, Nottinghamshire, and so forth, and they go to Holland because they feel they'll have a more independent life there. The whole lot of them, about 200 of them, but they find Holland a bit too easygoing. And then they come back, and they're sponsored to go to America. They get onto two boats in the Thames. They sail down the Thames. One of them springs a leak. They pull in at Hastings. They pull in at Dover. They set off again for another month. They come back again into Southampton. Hampton. They sell one of the ships, dump half the stuff that they should have brought with them, and everyone piles onto the one ship. Then they make it out another few yards, have to go back into Portsmouth because there's another problem with it. And finally, they leave from Plymouth. And that's why they decide to call the new place Plymouth Rock. So they were not, they weren't, you know, they weren't namby-pamby people. They were ready for hardship, but they just hadn't brought, you know, a full range of skill sets with them, because their real objective was leaving. The push factors were they wanted to get away from sort of that religious sort of, you know, sort of structure they were in. So they were religious folk first, rather than, you know, Antarctic pioneer explorers of the New World primarily. You know, if we ever explore Mars, it's most likely we'll have astronauts and engineers and so forth, rather than a set of people who religiously feel crushed on Earth and want to have the liberty to be on Mars in this way.
Hey, that's the plot of many a good sci-fi novel and film, should be said. But at modern Thanksgiving, it is actually a real thing. People have to say what they're thankful for.
In fact, they don't have to say what they're thankful for, because there's a proclamation from George Washington, which he issued in 1789, which detailed what they should be thankful for, which is that they had founded the first great nation that was founded on religious tolerance, parity of esteem, and the first nation ever to be founded on the idea of the happiness of people, and that the ambition should be the happiness of people. And he said that they should give thanks for their discreet good government. So obviously that's something they'll be doing now.
I think it was Plato or Aristotle, though, said the first aim of all men is to be happy.
I think, Sean, you're right.
Yeah, thank you. You're not, though. Someone's texted in to say already, tell Tomas it was 1492 and Virginia is not in New England.
I didn't. Okay.
Perfect. Yeah, if you say so.
Okay. No. I could. I don't know what I said. If I didn't say 1492, I apologize.
Yeah. In fact, Thanksgiving celebrates stealing America off the Native Americans. Says another texter. But don't feel left out, Serena. You're getting abused too.
Someone.
I haven't done anything yet. Yeah. He said hello. No, not the Australian lady. She's way too biased towards certain types of movies.
I've always admitted that.
This tweet is from someone who calls himself Caligula. So, are there any movies in which somebody marries a donkey today? In which case, we're happy out. Yeah. Caligula has nothing to worry about. though one could say Daddy's Home 2 is perhaps a bit of an ass.
I like what you did there. so we're doing Daddy's Home 2 and Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah. How do you feel about the whole Mel Gibson's in a movie and yeah?
This isn't going to come across well, I suppose. This isn't very politically correct to say, but I think everyone deserves redemption. And I think that, my gosh, his acts, what he did all those years ago was so wrong. But how long if someone has seen the light, that sounds very religious, but if someone has sort of gone, you know what I did was wrong and has changed their ways, do we not forgive them?
I suppose we do. Do we know? Has he changed his ways?
We don't know. He's gone quiet and stuff. And look, I have to say, I interviewed him last week and he is, he came across, if you knew nothing, you'd think he was a lovely man, but he is on edge the whole time. He's very fidgety, very nervous. The whole time I was talking to him, he was twitching at his beard and, you know, so he's on edge and stuff. I don't know. Like how much longer do you, if you've done wrong once, do you not get forgiven?
Well, when you met him, did you make any anti-Semitic comments?
None at all.
Well, there you go then. That's one more proof you need. But I mean, he has a drink problem. But I assume he's not drinking or he wouldn't be working.
I'd assume he's not drinking. He is working. I don't know him personally. I don't know what's going on, but what we've seen, I don't know.
Yeah.
I know it's not the right
thing to be
saying.
Well, you're prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, if he has changed his ways, and we don't know that he has, we don't know that he hasn't, but, you know, this was a long time ago, and if he has changed his way, well, yeah, you know, if someone says what I've done was wrong and I've made every effort to change what I'm doing and the way I live my life and stuff, well then, yes, but then he goes and does Daddy's Home too, so I don't know how long I can forgive him.
Oh, well, now that's just desperation.
do you know what I don't forgive him for?
What?
Here we go. He, for so long, rode on the coattails of Australia, saying, I'm an Australian and how great am I? And you mention Australia and he just cowers. He doesn't he doesn't admit he's an Australian anymore. He doesn't like to say he's an Australian. So, but that, I'm angry.
Right. Wasn't he born in the States, though?
He was born in the States. I think he came over when he was quite young. But, you know, when he started his film career, he used to say he was Australian. He was a proud Aussie. And then I don't know what happened, but something turned and he's no longer a proud Aussie.
Oh, dear. Mm. So when you interviewed him, did he not? He didn't do the where are you from, where are you from thing?
He did, but it was very brushed over. He did the whole, where are you from? I went, oh, from Australia. And I said, and I had to say to him, when you lived in Australia, where did you live?
Oh, so we said, where are you from? I assume he meant, I know you're from Australia. Where in Australia are you from?
No.
You just said Australia, and that's all he wanted to know.
And then I said to him, and where did you live? And he was Sydney and Melbourne, and then that was it. So, okay. Yeah, there you go. But anyway, we've got Daddy's Home too, and we've got Battle of the Sexes.
Right.
Which is brilliant. Billie Jean King is someone we should be looking up to.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And Battle of the Sexes is based on real events. This thing did happen.
In 1973.
And it's Steve Carell, isn't it?
He plays Bobby Riggs.
Yeah. Is he convincing as a tennis player?
Do you know what? Yeah, now I
what are his legs like? And does he do any manspreading in the course of the film?
Well, Bobby Riggs does lots of manspreading. I was wondering, though, I'd love to read up on, I wasn't able to find the info, how much was them actually playing and how much was stunt tennis players? Can you call them stunt tennis players or doubles? But if you watch it, you think, oh, my God, Steve Carell, is this just a caricature of Bobby Riggs? And then you watch Bobby Riggs, you go, it's no caricature. That was actually Bobby Riggs. Yeah, he nails the performance.
All right. Caligula Caesar was back on to say, a good reviewer tries not to be biased, but of course you know that. You're just incredibly arrogant. And yes, I am Caligula. So,
I don't know.
I've been called arrogant by someone who's named himself after the leader of the Roman Empire. Guess you must have me there. What wines are we going to be talking about today, Tomas?
Obviously, we'll talk about a Californian wine, needless to say. So, we have an American wine from California, from Russian River Valley, which is a beautiful, big, buttery Chardonnay, but has some, you know, lovely Christmas at the end of it. So it's something, you know, really, it's an attractive one. And it's the start of kind of, it's round two for Californian wines in this country. They're on the rise here for sure. Previously, in the bad old Celtic Tiger days, there was, you know, icon Celtic Tiger sort of Californian wines, four-figure, three-figure sums, £100, £300, £800. So those wines are definitely still there. Screaming Eagle, sine qua non, if you have £1,000, they can give you a half a bottle of a nice Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. Screaming Eagle, you have to get onto a waiting list, and the waiting list is about 2 to 3 years long. And when you when you get onto the waiting list, you get offered they allow you to buy one bottle for every six. You have to buy five of their ordinary sort of £400 bottled wines before you can buy the one of the Screaming Eagle. And these wines are big sellers in London right now, in the probably the most expensive sort of wine shops right in centre, in Berkeley Square, or in Berkeley Square Hedonism, and it's exactly as it does what it says on the tin. The wines are unbelievable in there, and all of the people from the city just seem to live in that. So this doesn't do that at all. This is more like €25. It's not down at it's not at €8 a bottle. So there is that out there from California. You've got the Blush Infidel and so forth. So this is trying the kind of the middle line, and it's coming back in nicely. Time for Christmas, I think, where you've got it's not a cheap wine, but it's, you know, it's not £50. Yeah. It's not £300, and it's a really, really attractive. Attractive wine, so we'll have a talk about that. Russian River Valley, and the other one is Sting's wine.
This is
When We Dance, and this is Sting and his wife, Trudy Styler, and they make this very, very attractive Chianti. You know, obviously it's very fashionable. Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie making Chateau Miraval, but Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, you might, I mean,
yeah, but they don't really make it. It's kind of they divided the vineyard in half.
Well, they it's going to be the subject matter of the divorce, of course. But for the moment, they're still making the same wine. I would be recommending anyone, if you see the Chateau Miraval with Pitt, Jolie, Perrin on it, which is what's on it now, I'd buy those ones in case we worth a few bob in a few years time, you know.
Where do you get them?
When they split them, you can get them around town in all good wine shops, as they say. Terroirs, I think, have them out in Donnybrook. And but the thing is, this could be having shattering a few illusions, but Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt not probably in the vineyard getting their hands dirty.
No, probably not.
But Sting does.
But Sting does.
Good man, Sting. Right, back in a couple of minutes.
It's 7 minutes past three of a Friday, which means it's movies and booze time. We have a hashtag. It is crispy movies, snacks of the 50-foot women, the Tato after tomorrow, and a salt on Precinct 13. There's millions of them, and the standard is fantastic as usual. Tomás Clancy and Serena Bellissimo join us once again. Sean, please ask the wine guy, where might you buy the Californian red La Cigar Volant?
The Cigar Volant is not in Ireland at the present moment, but Berry Brothers used to have it, and you will be able to import it yourself, as they say. If you have a look on the web, you can actually get it on in English ones and have it sent over here. But it's a good wine. It's the fantastic thing is it's a Grenache, Syrah Mourvèdre. It's a Châteauneuf du Pape style wine from California. And the Cigar Volant is that's the French for flying saucer. And because they passed an edict in 1956 we'll say the 50s in case it's 55. There's some very pernickety people out there, 1492, 1493. They passed an act in the 1950s in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, which was forbidding flying saucers from landing on Châteauneuf-du-Pape vineyards.
Really?
Yes.
And who did they actually tell about this?
They broadcasted widely. And you know what? They've never had a landing there, so obviously it
interesting
works.
Yes. Same question. Estevalia Merlot 2012.
It sounds I don't know it. It's obviously a Chilean. I really Esther.
Estevalia, Estivalia. Yeah, it's a Merlot from 2012.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I apologise. It's a nice Chilean. There are some good Chileans out there.
That's a rare day. Yes. David says, can Mr. Wine review some of the Maynard James Keenan, a singer with Tool wines sometimes? Great singer and his wines are meant to be lovely, says David.
Right. I haven't tasted them. But the problem is that there's now an entire... I've done an article on rock and roll and their wines. Sting is obviously one that we're having looked at today, but there's about 50 that I would really like to try. They just don't bring them here. They're very expensive, because most of them are actually pitching the price to their fame rather than anything else,
And because we've had a fair few, I think the Rolling Stones have one.
They have a fantastic series, and Bob Dylan has some. Cliff Richard obviously has
identify himself. Yes.
has a nice vineyard that it was so well made he didn't spot it was his own one.
Yeah. I think he didn't like it though when he was asked to taste it.
Yeah, he definitely was resistant to it. I think it was a good one. It was a good one.
And Patrick says that When We Dance is stunning, really rich and full bodied. His entire range is lovely. Yeah. Says Patrick. Now we're not going
to
do that.
Yeah, we're coming out to second, but it's really good, and he is making it himself. This is actually the hand of Sting.
Right, but he's no experience as a winemaker, so he must have somebody telling him what to do.
There's a couple of older people there that in the farm that they bought, and they've shown him how to do it. But he's kind of learnt it more in an organic way, as if you'd sort of grown up there, and you're watching your aunts and uncles make it and so forth. So he's really got into that. And in fact, although the wine is fantastic, they do an incredibly good olive oil, which is really wonderful, and they make honey. Honey I haven't tasted, but they've beautiful natural honey and olive oil, so it's part of this whole holistic sort of sustainable program. He's very into it, and that's really what he's doing. He's kind of using it as a kind of a flash post and flashcards for telling the rest of the world about this kind of produce. Because he certainly doesn't need the money.
Yeah,
but it really is a kind of an intellectual engagement for him.
Is all wine in the United States just on the West Coast? If you live in Michigan or something,
I'm glad you asked me that, Sean. There is wine in every single state in America, including Hawaii and Alaska. The Alaskan wine, admittedly, is made from concentrated juice that they import into the state. So that's a quarter tick as being wine. They get two crops a year in Hawaii, and they make quite an interesting Viognier. Tasted one of those, and a Gewürztraminer. But you can make, there's wine being made everywhere, every single state in the United States of America at the moment. This was the dream of Jefferson when he brought those wines into Virginia. He was very interested in having, in getting, civilizing the entire country by planting vines everywhere. The exceptional places for wine in the United States, apart from California, are Washington and Oregon. Oregon, unbelievably good Pinot Noir, and it's much more on the same sort of level of that we're looking for European vineyards. And the New York Finger Lakes have an AVA there where they make exquisite Rieslings and some quite fine Gewürztraminer as well, very like the Moselle. So across America, you could travel from coast to coast drinking wine, including Texas and a variety of other amusing states that you wouldn't immediately associate with it.
All right.
Great.
Any hoodles? That's this message starts with. This question is for Tomas. It's a little time sensitive, as I hope to give the gift on Wednesday, the 29th of November. Mm-hmm. I have two bottles of fancy wine. I'd like to give one as a gift to a woman who helped me out enormously over the past year, but I know nothing about wine. Don't even drink. Vodka is more my thing, sorry. So you two drink. They were due to be drunk around 2010, but I wonder if they would still be as good as 2017. It's Chateau Lieuville Poitfair. Chateau Lieuville Poitfair. You can look at those yourself.
Yeah.
The second one is Margaret River, Lewin 1995 Estate. From Lewin Estate. It's those Mr. Lynn Cabso.
Those are two brilliant wines, and they are both entirely sustained. I can tell you the Chateau Lieuville Poitfair 1995 still going strong, and that's the one to give because there'll be no problems with it, and or there should be very few problems with it. It's a beautiful Bordeaux from there's three vineyards there: Lieuville Les Cass, Lieuville Baton, and then this one in the middle, the Poitfray. That's exceptional and is a good present. I mean, you're looking at a couple hundred euros there without any difficulty.
Right. Okay.
The 95 Lewin Estate Art Series is a beautiful wine. It has more like a 10. 15 year sort of lifespan. So the 95, 90, it's touch and go.
Yeah.
I'd love it because, when you get a Chardonnay that's old, it kind of, you get those kind of nutty flavors and it goes a little Madeirized with the oxidation. And I really enjoy that. But, other people mightn't, whereas they'll know the other one has got a bit of classy, good dark fruit. So that's the one I'd go for the present, for sure.
Eric, who's in Ballinasloe, says, can you get Gosling Creek white wine in Ireland? Oh, that's not like Ryan Gosling. Does he have a wine as well? From my creek.
Gosling Creek. Gosling Creek. Not one I'm overly familiar with. Gosset is what I thought you were going to say, and that champagne is available. But yeah. Gosling Creek, yeah.
Tony says, my wife is going off wine. Help! Always liked a nice Rioja, but finds them too strong now. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for a light fruity red. Please advise, I can keep drinking the whole bottle.
Ribera del Duero. So that's basically, you're going to have the Tintafino. You're going to have the Tempranillo that you have for Rioja,
yeah.
But it's slightly cooler. So it won't get up to those kind of 14.5%, 15% sort of alcohol levels. And you get a kind of a much more restrained sort of alcohol base, but the same kind of quality and the same shape of the taste profile for that. So Ribera del Duero, find them. Portia is one a good one to look out for.
And Owen on Twitter wonders, every time you uncork a bottle of Sting's wine, will it play a message in a bottle? Let's move on to our first wine, and it's the white.
It's the white. Yeah. This is the Fry Brothers Chardonnay from the Russian River Valley. Now, so we're back to California. Yeah, it's not the only place that makes wine in America, as we said, but it's the best place for making wine en masse in America. And from just north of Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, right the way through to Eureka, the top sort of edge of the state, you find the grape growing portion of it. You can there's about 50 different types of AVAs or Appalachian Controlli in America. The Russian River Valley is about an hour's drive north of San Francisco. So San Francisco Bay is a huge bay, but the the main English subsequent to Mexican English and French people had explorers had really taken that over. Russian River Valley further up. It's a big, nice, open river bringing you straight into the heart at the end of it of Sonoma and about midway up the kind of Napa Valley. And then the river sneaks on a bit further up inside. And what it does is it draws in cold air And fogs all the way in from the Pacific, in for, you know, 50 or 60 kilometres inland. It's called the Russian River Valley because, in fact, the Russian fur traders went all over this this area. They came in here and they made it the biggest sort of trading port for fur on the Pacific. So they were trading with Russia, with Japan indeed, and then a lot of the other sort of states around there from this kind of outpost. So that's where people said, oh, it's the Russian River Valley. you know, that's what it was. It was also because, as we know, California is called the Golden State. It's not about the sun. It's because they found gold there.
Yeah.
So that's why the Golden State. The motto of California is Eureka. I found it. That's having found the gold. Because, of course, rather amusingly, but not to the Mexican state, they shook hands on buying California from Mexico in a deal approximately 5 to 6 weeks, a few months at the most, from the official announcement that they had indeed discovered gold and lots of it in the northern part of the region. I would say that's where you would have buyer's regret or seller's regret on a very large scale. And that was in 1848. And so they had loads of money and they bought lots of fur, and that's why this became such an important valley. So what you've got here is you have a beautiful estate. The Fry brothers, 125 years old, the cabins and all the other elements of the winery were all built out of old staves from barrels that we used. You know, so it's very sustainable and rather beautiful. It's a real kind of ranch kind of feel. It really does have a ranch feel more than a conventional European winery. And in and amongst all this is some really exceptional Chardonnay. And what happens is the fog comes in, lands over the top of it, and keeps it cool during the day. Otherwise, the rest of the place around there is baking hot. And it keeps it cool, and that's what we want. Chardonnay needs slight cool, or a little bit cooler than most areas, because it's at around about, say, it's quite low indeed, around about 38, 36 on latitude, whereas we are at about 53. Burgundy's at about 44. So they're basically, they're miles
Tomas
down.
Is wrong. It's 42.7.
Sorry, yes. And so they're basically down where Spain and then ultimately Algeria is.
Yeah.
That's where you're looking for, where the Californian vines are. So they get this artificial coolness by the fog that comes in. This wine had been love bombed. The Ernst & J. Gallo people took it over. And in fact, Gina Gallo, who's one of the current crop of Gallos that run it, she's a wonderful winemaker and, you know, studied, you know, really great boutique winemaking, very interested in wild fermentation and, you know, beautiful use of oak and not too much irrigation and very sustainable growth. So basically, they've really put a lot of money into this. And what you've got here is you've got, you know, surly in-barrel fermentation, you know, the kind of sort of heavy sort of human interaction that costs a lot of money to make these wines. And if it was in sort of Burgundy, you'd have to be charging 60 or 70 euros a bottle for what you're doing here. But they're able to do this because they're such a large firm and they have the backing to do it. And I think it's a rather gorgeous wine. Very drinkable, very, very luscious.
Mm, yeah.
Nice bit of sort of apricot, you know, it's very ripe apricot, a little bit of a tiny sort of element of honey, but nothing too unctuous, and then has a beautiful, soft, lifting finish. And have that chilled with, you know, some turkey for Thanksgiving. Have that chilled with some really beautiful roast pork. So pork, you know, sort of pan fried, get a nice crispy edge to it, and have that lovely and cool. It's delicious.
Oh God, I feel like pork now as well. Oh crikey. Our hashtag is Crispy Movies, Monster Munch Inc, Smoky Bacon and the Bandit, and my current favourite, Dances with Wotsits. We're going to take a break. What movie would you like to do first, Serena?
Battle of the Sexes.
Battle of the Sexes after this.
It says here that you're offering the men's winner $12,000 and $1,500 to the women's.
The men's prize needs to be that high to attract the best players. We're trying to make this the most prestigious tournament in America.
And paying the women less than ever makes it more prestigious.
It's just simply a question of what we can afford.
People pay to see the men play. They're the draw.
They're 8 times more of a draw?
Sorry?
You're offering the men's winner exactly 8 times what you're offering the women's winner. Do we bring in an eighth of the crowd?
I don't know percentages, but...
Well, they sold the exact same amount of tickets to the women's final today as the men's. Isn't that right, Jack?
Today, yeah, I suppose so.
Same sales, same prize money makes sense to me.
There you go. That's a clip from Battle of the Sexes. That was Emma Stone there as Billie Jean King. Right. So this is, you might as well tell us, this is based on a true event.
Basically, 1973, Bobby Riggs came out. Now, Bobby Riggs at the time was a 55-year-old, retired, ex-champion. Like, he was great in his day, but he's now 55. Now, he's still fantastic when he takes to the court and he's there playing with his mates. He has a real gambling addiction as well. And he was feeling a bit lost. So he saw the attention that the ladies were getting as well. And he decided that he wanted to show that the women don't actually deserve what they're getting, because they don't deserve to be on par with the men, because even at 55, he could beat the number one.
Yeah.
Now, he tried to bait Billie Jean King into this match, but she was smarter than that. She knew the damage that this could do. So the Australian player at the moment, who is in the news for all the wrong reasons in Australia, Margaret Court, became number one. She ended up beating Billie Jean King. That was the first battle of the sexes. She lost. And then that's when Billie Jean went, we can't end it on that note. So she had no other choice but to play Bobby Riggs. Now, still now, this is one of the most watched sporting events ever. Over 90 million people worldwide watched this event.
Crikey.
It was massive. I'm going to start with the good things about this film. I loved it. I love the fact that we're getting to see Billie Jean King's story on the big screen. I'm not as big a tennis fan as Esther is. Esther knows the ins and outs and everything, but I am a big fan. So I think if you are a tennis fan, regardless of what era you were born in, you would know the significance of Billie Jean King. She basically changed women's tennis. As you heard in that clip, they were offering her less, and that's when she went, you know what? No, I'm going to start my own association. Went off, and for a dollar herself, and I think they're about 10 or 11 other women, went and joined this association. And that's when she started to get women's pay. It wasn't equal straight away. It still isn't equal now. But, you know, she got it up there. My problem with this film is that it was great seeing Billie Jean's story. I wish they didn't call it Battle of the Sexes, because it's focusing on the event, which was a monumental event, a historic event. But they needed to give Billie Jean's backstory, but the problem was when they did that, it slowed the film down. And when it started to pick up momentum again was the Battle of the Sexes, because you've gone in to watch a film about the Battle of the Sexes. What also happened is it basically ended at, that's no spoiler, it ended at the Battle of the Sexes. That was the finale. And, you know, at the credits, there's the, you know, what happened next.
Right.
I wanted to know what happened next. I think Billie Jean King deserves more than what she was given in this film. But because they
is the film really more about Billie Jean King? Because, no, who cares about Riggs? Billie Jean King is a legendary athlete. Riggs isn't.
Yeah, but the problem is, it's like, do you remember the film Australia with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman? It got panned. But it got panned because they called it Australia. So you expected to see a film about Australia. It was nothing about, the only thing about Australia was the fact that it was set in Australia. So I think had they titled that film differently, it would have received different criticism.
Mm.
I think the same thing with this film. They've called it Battle of the Sexes. They should have probably just focused on the battle and given us more of a backstory on Bobby Riggs as well, because he had an interesting story. I mean, he wasn't as monumental as Billie Jean King is. But then as a result, I don't feel like I got enough of either. I'm still going to recommend this film to everybody. I think it's a great watch, but I just feel that it could have been a much better film if they had called it. Now, I'm not in the marketing department, so someone else come up with a better name, but even if it was called The Billie Jean King Story.
Yeah, though I suppose Battle of the Sexes gives it attention, gives it a story arc.
Yeah.
People, you know, will want to know what happened, even though Google will tell them in 10 seconds.
Exactly. But that's the problem. It gives you the story arc, so you go in expecting that. So when you're seeing, I mean, there's beautiful scenes between Billie Jean King and Marilyn, her girlfriend, and so beautifully filmed. And I'm feeling the love, I'm feeling the inner turmoil that Billie Jean is going through, but I felt like it slowed the film down. And then it, you know, picked up its pace again when it was Battle of the Sexes, and then it slowed down again. So that for me probably is the only problem, and I'm really picking at it to pick at it, because
I suppose they had to deal with her sexuality, because that was another really interesting thing about Billie Jean King.
They really did, but that's why I just wish it was a different focus. I wish the focus was solely on Billie Jean King, and the Battle of the Sexes played a part in it, but I would have liked to have seen past the Battle of the Sexes, because that relationship, it was made out like herself and Marilyn were in this amazing relationship, and they were at the time, but ended rather acrimoniously. So after 7 years, basically, it was Marilyn who outed Billie Jean King. And at that time, it was 1981, and at that time, it could have ruined her career. And Marilyn was suing Billie Jean King for palimony.
Or really?
Alimony, palimony.
Palimony, I think is what they call it in those days, because obviously they couldn't be married.
Yeah, so... yeah, so there were, I think there was. This is a missed opportunity. What I'm hoping is that Hollywood sees what interest there is in this story, because I did walk in going, wow, Billie Jean King, I have such admiration for you. I walked out going, I am in awe of this woman. What she did, her courageousness, her, she backed herself. Like, she went, you know what, I'm worth more than this. I'm worthy of what I'm asking for.
Which is hard to do.
Exactly.
Yeah, and those, especially in those
1973,
days.
1973, and she was a 29-year-old. At the time when she was doing it. So, I mean, we also need to focus on the performances. Emma Stone, she is this generation's Meryl Streep. She's like a chameleon. She can, you know, we can believe her in La La Land, we can believe her in Easy A, and then we can believe that she is playing Billie Jean King, and there's no ounce of mimicry in this portrayal.
Okay, all right, because actually that was one of, because my image of Billie Jean King is she's quite tall, a rangy, very athletic looking woman.
Yeah.
Emma Stone doesn't look like that at all.
She put on 15 pounds of muscle for this role. Now, she said herself she's not that great at tennis, and as I said at the beginning, I'm not sure
that's
how much.
That's why they call it acting, darling, yes.
But she is brilliant in this, and you do feel, you feel everything that she's going through. You also feel that Billie Jean King was also carrying a lot of pressure on her shoulders, because not only did she say, you know, it's all focusing on her and the fact that she said, we're breaking away, but there were these other courageous women behind her, besides her, going, we will join this new Women's Tennis Association and, you know, leave the Lawn Tennis Association, where we're guaranteed not a lot of money, but we're guaranteed some money. So, yeah, I just, I felt all that anguish and stuff. I just wish we felt more. I would have loved to have seen more of Billie Jean King's story.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you felt that the end of the film wasn't satisfactory somehow.
It wasn't, because, but it was when you look at the title, Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah,
that,
because
I mean,
that's
that is the climax.
Yeah.
But it's not when you're just thinking Billie Jean King's story is just getting started. And then, you know, they give you the little tidbits at the end and you just go, I would have liked to see that happen. I would like to see that happen, because it was a lot more than what we'd seen.
Battle of the Sexes too. The portrayal of Riggs, is it sympathetic?
It's not unsympathetic. I think it just shows him as he was. And that's what I love about this. This is from the directors of Little Miss Sunshine, who directed Steve Carell in Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you think you're watching Steve and you're going, oh, this is a caricature of Riggs. No. That actually
that was Riggs. Was like.
You watch it back on YouTube and it's scene for scene exactly the same.
Right. Okay. So that's worth going to see then.
I'd definitely check this out. But I also want to see another film.
But say as a date movie...
Yeah, I think
for couples, will men be resistant to going to see it because the thing is, like, you know, I'm going to go and then apologise for my huge gonads.
Not
as many men have been doing already today on the programme.
Not at all. You don't need to be doing any manspreading or anything in this either.
All right. Good to know. Right. We'll take a break. One more movie and one more wine to go after this. Five 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. Our hashtag is, let me just check. I was going to say crisp movies. It is crispy movies, it should be said. Pringle white female. Finding Hunky Dory, Pringler's List, Doritos Way, and Summer of Sam's Boats. Lots of people have used that final one. Tomas and Serena are still with us. A few questions for you, Tomas. Yeah. Hubby doesn't drink, and I don't want to open and waste a bottle. Any decent half bottles or quarter bottles out there?
There are. First of all, if this is a long-term, ongoing thing, and the marriage is going to survive, you might consider...
We're taking into account.
Yes, very much so. Well, obviously... it's a sacrifice for a wine lover to make, to marry out in that
it's
way.
It's a mixed marriage.
It's a mixed
Did
marriage.
Your parents approve?
So what I would think about there is, think about investing in a Coravan. This is the best new form of kind of corkscrew and opener. And what it is the Coravan goes on the top of the wine. You punch down in it like a corkscrew and it sends down a needle. It was invented by a spinal surgeon, and the needle is one of medical grade needle, and it's hollow in the middle, and it cores out, it spreads out the the cork and it goes down through. You can then pour a shot or two. You can pour a glass out for yourself. Mm. Then when you take this out, it reseals the cork.
Brilliant.
While putting in a little bit of inert gas to, so that it doesn't make a vacuum there. And it is absolutely all the rage. They're not cheap. They're a couple of hundred euros.
Okay.
But all
Christmas
of
Christmas is coming.
Christmas is coming, and all of the big sort of wine bars and hotels have now got them and can give you a glass of
Sauternes
by the glass now.
Caravan. Yes. Cremant is the new Champers. However, it's much cheaper in the UK. $14.99 here. Is there anywhere other than Lidl selling this cheaper? Paul wants to know.
No, there isn't. Both Lidl and Aldi are sort of down there competing at those levels. There's a 20 euro one in Super Value, and you can get them at that kind of range. But, you know, again, don't shoot the messenger. The reality of this here, the problem for us is not the vendors. It's the fact that we have a super high rate of tax on champagne because we tax bubbles highly. This was Devil Era. This is back. This is a good 40, 50 years ago, where they have a rate for still wine and then a rate for sparkling wine because it was the wine of the ascendancy class,
of course. Protestant drink, that's what it was. As a priest, I have suffered greatly at the hands of kind-hearted but clueless old ones who offer me a glass of wine. They serve a long-opened, very oxidised cream sherry, which is awful. Yes. Having visited Jerez, I fell in love with sherry, really good sherry, which is amazingly good value. Question, would the wine guy ever do a sherry tasting? I think we have done sherry tasting.
We have done a sherry tasting. I'd be well on for doing another one. And there's some unbelievably good sherries out there. And because they are not in the highest of fashion, you can be getting really top quality there for 10, 15, 20, 25 euros. Amazing value out there. Esporto, I won't give you, go and look for the ones you like yourself.
Okay. Do you find that wines from the Rioja region are moving away from the strong oak flavours of a Crianza or Reserva that I've always loved? I'm finding I have to buy wines from Ribera del Duero and Valdepenas to get these flavours, says Niall.
They're you can go to La Alta Rioja estate. So the Alta Rioja still make it in that more august sort of oak, well oak style. But a lot of the newer, and Marcus de Riscal have some of their top wines, their sort of wines in the 20 and 25 and 30 category, still made in that style. But a lot of the newer estates, the caller there is absolutely correct. They're making them fruit forward because people want less of the kind of seed brittleness that comes with aged oak. So it's there, but what you do is choose those wineries that are going that way. But yeah, good Valpenendes and good Ribera del Duero, some of it will give you the same.
The hashtag, by the way, is Crispy Movies, The Lord of the Onion Rings. The moment we've all been waiting for, let's move on to Sting's wine.
Sting's wine. Now, this wine has, some people will be, the first thought when you get to it, it's not the purity and cleanliness and linear quality that you get with a lot of Chiantis. So a lot of Chiantis are Sangiovese dominated, and what they're going for is a slightly zesty, or what we call frizzante, sort of feel. So they have a little truculence in the mouth, a little bit leftover sort of fermentation, and just youthfulness to them. And they want high acidity at the end of it because they're cutting through the pasta. You've got a big, rich sort of pasta with lovely, rich, mushroomy sauce. And then you scoop that out. It's kind of unctuous and mouth-filling. And then you have a glass of this thing in here. And wham!
Serena's actually drooling. Not a good look in you, really. Especially if you're wearing a white top.
So that's for that. And it cuts through it and it's nice and clean and so forth. This is a vin biologique. So as you might expect from Sting, he's all about the environment. In his music, in the way he lived and the way he lives, he's been very interested in this. So he didn't, again, go in. He was unlike a lot of the kind of rock star people who go in and buy a well-known vineyard, rebrand it and have it out there, or go in with a joint venture with a pre-existing winery. He actually bought a beautiful estate that he loved, that he saw, good old olive trees, ancient sort of but uncared for vines, and he restored afford it over years living there with his wife. And now apparently they bought it round about the time of Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, which both Sting and his wife were starred in. And so it's kind of, in my mind, is always associated with that as well. But that smokiness, we won't go of the barrels. Yes. He says. But what you've got here is the slight, with Van Biology. So if you've got an organic wine or a natural wine, what you don't get is the clarity and cleanliness that you get if you percolate through sulfur to clean it out. And you also, you go for a sort of a fermentation that is, you leave it in open tanks. You crush the grapes, leave them in big open tanks in the warm air, and then they spontaneously ferment from the yeast that's in the air over time. That takes a long time for it to get going and then work. It's like bread. Sort of sourdough, you've got the madre, you put it in, you march up the dough, and then you go away for a few hours and you see if it will spontaneously do. Sometimes it will, sometimes it won't. Now, if you're making white sliced bread for, you know, and you want a billion of them, you can't sit there waiting for this to happen by accident. So you've got inoculated yeast to get this going. Or, as we know, Margaret Thatcher invented white sliced bread when she was working there. You aerate, you just fire air in to work to mirror the idea of the expansion from this. So this is kind of waiting for that to happen. And when that does happen, then it doesn't all ferment at the same time. So a bit of the fermentation goes and that's going to perfection. Some of it goes too far. And you get kind of sort of strange balsamic sort of aromas. Some doesn't go. Some of the yeasts that come in there are not perfect, and you get kind of a slightly musky flavour to it. And I think what you get is you get a kind of a more complex arrangement. But think of it this way: you make a pasta sauce, and I won't do the whole thing. But you have pasta here, right? You get the tin of tomatoes, and you throw on tomatoes onto it. Bang! And that's, you go, look, there's the sauce. You go, well, yeah, it's just tomato sauce, but it's very uniform. You start throwing things into it, little bits of all kinds of other materials into this, and tarragons and a little bit of anise, even, all kinds of, to try and spice this up. And then it's varied in its flavour, and some of it works and some of it doesn't work, but we love the complexity of it, and we appreciate that in baking and cooking. And that's what you're doing in kind of natural winemaking. You're allowing those kind of multiplicity of layers of flavours to happen. So this is not a singular wine. It's a muscular, beautiful, complex wine that says, yes, you know, one eye is larger than the other. They you know, they're not the uniform height. Some of those teeth are uneven, you know.
Does that mean, though, it depends on, you know, the bottle we have open in front of us,
yes,
may well taste differently to another bottle with the same label?
It'll certainly taste different every year, but if they're bottling from the same vat, what will change is, yeah, so you could have a lot of bottles that'll be the same, but then the next barrel there might be a little variance from that, and the next barrel and so forth. In fact, he's got more consistency than that, but he's even got sort of organic approval, so it's been certified as biologic and organic, and, you know, made in this more natural style. And, you know, you've got to applaud doing that, because it would have been so easy to make a very conventional industrial style sort of Chianti that ticked all the boxes and you didn't have to talk about it, and it's a bang, it works. And he could also very easily have charged any price he wanted for it, but he's kind of pitched it so that it's out there at $18.95 because he's, you know, the rugged authenticity of it available. You know, he's not trying to make it.
Sorry, somebody, Brenda, has texted in to say, does Sting's wine have a whiff of self-satisfying smugness about it?
Do you know, there could be a little bit of the far side of that. You can get this from sips.com, S-I-Y-P-S, that's sommelier in your pocket, sips.com.
That sounds vaguely disconcerting.
There's a little bit of smell. I don't think so. I think you have to dig to find that it's Sting's wine. Now,
yeah,
if you're
it's
a fan,
not, there's not a big, you know, thing on the front saying, yeah, it's Sting's wine.
There's,
yeah,
a nice sort of a balletic figure on the front
the
of it, but it's not
gorgeous.
Saying Sting.
It's really, it is a nice label.
It's,
yeah,
a beautiful sort of a cat ballet.
It reminds, it's a cross of Zorba the Greek meets Audrey Hepburn. That's what I get when I look at
okay,
that.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. So kind of a trans Zorba.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting concept. It is a yeah. I like it, I, yeah, must say.
I think it's a yeah, lovely, fascinating, good, interesting wine, well made, you know, quite amazing from somebody who's, that's not their primary job. Their primary job was being in the police first and then going off and having a whole second career. And here's the third career. Honeymaker to the stars.
Okay, it's not bad. Well done, Sting. We did get a question earlier on about a mixed marriage, as in she likes wine, he doesn't drink at all. And Tomas did recommend that device, a caravan. Someone else, a few people actually text and said, just buy a wine box.
You can have a glass of wine when you want. Obviously, you're treating that that suggestion with the contempt it deserves. Now, Brian says, is a caravan not something a Southsider owns in Wexford?
Ooh.
What is a nice dry white wine? Not too sweet. My wife likes a dry white and has tried Pinot Grigio, Chardonnay and many others, but they're all too sweet.
Right. Well, you definitely need to go for a Riesling from Germany. If you go for an Alsace Riesling, you could get some sweetness back in there. But look for something from the Moselle or from Rheingau. They're very well priced because, again, they're not overly popular. And there's also from Clare Valley in Australia. Clare Valley makes can get you a really bone dry Riesling there, and I think you could like it a lot. It's rather gorgeous.
Okay, right, time to talk about a comedy film. Unfortunately, we don't have one. Instead, we have Daddy's Home 2. In this clip, Mel Gibson and John Lithgow are disturbed to find that someone's messed around with the thermostat.
Did you touch the thermostat? Did you turn it up?
Well, of course not. Did somebody fiddle with the thermostat?
Yes, it's 85 degrees.
85? Do you have any idea how much even a few degrees can impact the gas bill?
Of course I do. It's unthinkable.
Dad, Kurt, what's going on in here? Why is it so hot?
Someone fiddled with the thermostat.
What? Who would do that?
What is going on?
Adriana, she turned up the thermostat.
Said she fiddles with the thermostat at your place anytime she damn well pleases. Brad, do you let the kids touch the thermostat at your house?
What? No. The thermostat is a sacred covenant. I can't believe we're even talking about this. This is madness.
Is that a real thermostat they're talking about? Or I don't know.
Do you know what's funny?
What?
That wherever you hear this film reviewed, wherever you see this film being reviewed, that is the same clip that keeps getting put out there.
Oh my God, that's the only funny clip they have.
Yeah.
Let me guess. I haven't seen it, and I've only just heard that clip right now.
Give it to me, go on.
Mel Gibson and John Lithgow are basically exactly the same as Will Ferrell and Marky Mark, and they end up hugging and learning in the film as well.
How did you figure that out?
I don't know. I just have a weird gift.
Do. Look, in theory, this should have worked because it should have been funnier than it
depending
was.
On your definition of work.
Well, do you know what? A friend of mine was at the premiere screening, and she said, and I think it with some films, and this being one of them, it depends where you see them. And she said she was sort of got carried away by the audience because the audience were laughing at bits, and I think that sometimes has a knock-on effect and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it depends what mood you're in. You have to be in a very good mood. If you're not in a very good mood, you may not enjoy things.
Did something break in her just now?
Something may have fallen.
Okay.
I just think that... I did laugh sometimes. That thermostat scene is funny, especially if you are Irish. You know, substitute immersion for thermostat and you'll get that and it'll be funny. There were some very inappropriate jokes. And I'm all for the, you know, comedy is inappropriate. That's what makes us laugh. But there were some things, especially with what's happening right now. There was one scene where they're trying to tell the boy is going through learning about the birds and bees and stuff, and he's fallen in love with someone, and they're trying to tell him how he should approach that girl. And it was just wrong. It was just all wrong. And there were laughs, and I just felt very uncomfortable. Now, this isn't the whole film, but there are bits in there. That there's this Christmas carol that they keep going on about. I don't know if that's the most appropriately chosen Christmas carol. They rely very heavily on slapstick to make this work. There will be a Daddy's Home 3, and it doesn't really matter what I think.
No!
Of course there will be, because this opened at number one in the States, and it's still maybe 3 weeks later, it's still in the top three. So I have no doubt, like I was talking to the lads when they were in town and I said, you know, will we see you back here in 2 years' time for Daddy's Home 3? Because you told me there wouldn't be a Daddy's Home 2. And they said, you know, if we're given the right script like we were here, there will be. Doesn't matter about the script.
Yeah, right script means huge check.
Big time, and I think they got the huge check. What does make this work is the cast. The four of them, the four leads, really do work well with each other. There is great chemistry between Mark and Will. I love John Lithgow. He's good.
Yeah.
So I think if you're forced to go see this, focus on John Lithgow's performance. And I just I met him as well, and I want to take him home with me. Like I just want him to be my granddad.
Yeah, and leaving aside the whole stark raving insane part of it.
Yeah.
I never really rated Mel Gibson as a comedy actor. There's a bit too much gurning and overselling it.
Yeah, and I think someone, I wish I'd thought of this first, so I'm not going to take the credit for it. It's like seeing him back in playing Riggs in Lethal Weapon. You know, it's got that crazy.
Which apparently there is another Lethal Weapon.
Well, he did say that there is a possibility, like himself, Glover and Richard Donner are all talking about Lethal Weapon 5.
But given that Lethal Weapon 1, Danny Glover was just about to retire, is he like, you know...
Interesting times ahead.
Yeah. He's in a kind of a home someplace going, oh, no. Anyway, Simon's here. Tell us about some good things to do this weekend. Simon.
Sean, so it's the 350th anniversary of Jonathan Swift's birthday. And the Swift Festival is on all weekend. Christchurch Cathedral tonight are hosting Ballads of Swift's Dublin with singer and trad musician Padraig Ó n-Uailean. And that's at 7 p.m. Also, the West Cork Kayaking Club is holding its annual Fancy Dress Pub Quiz in Carney's Well and Skibbereen tomorrow night at 8 p.m. All pirates are very welcome, apparently, and all proceeds go to the club. And finally, Dub Web Fest kicks off this evening, Ireland's only web series festival. And I'm quite excited about this because Kazi David, the daughter of Seinfeld creator Larry David, has a series in it, and apparently it's really good. So go check that out.
Okay, good stuff. Thanks, Simon. Thanks, of course, to Tomas and Serena. Ivan's up next on News Talk. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Monday at 2 o'clock. Our production team today: Niamh Hassel, Michael Quillian, Amory Kane, Elaine Power, and Simon Tierney. Have a nice weekend.
Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. Gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.